faculty member in the physics department and a condensed matter theorist. And I knew about the construction of Aladdin. I knew there were delays in getting it up to operating specifications. And my real contact began in 1985 when my predecessor, Keith Simon, I guess he had a heart attack or something like that. But anyway, he had to step down, and the university, now this all happened on fairly short notice, and the university looked around to find someone who could, right away get on board, and they finally came around to asking me. I was chair of the department at that time, and so I said, fine, I'll come out. And it was a situation where the National Science Foundation had really put the university and SRC on notice. They were contemplating shutting down SRC altogether. Eric Bloch, director of the NSF at the time, would be making the decision. And my understanding of what had happened beforehand was that the NSF had asked a group of outside experts on storage room development and accelerator physics to just look over and evaluate what was going on here and the possibilities of reaching performance levels that were mentioned in the original proposal. And the outside experts were not very optimistic about ever reaching performance levels. And so this information was passed on to Bloch, and he had not made up his mind publicly when the guy came on. And then shortly after, he announced that he was going to shut down SRC and turn off Aladdin and just shut down the whole program out here. And he did that, and there was some money left over, and the chancellor, Irv Shane, came up with another $1 million from the Wisconsin Alumni Research Foundation, WARF, to keep operation going for approximately a year. So with this kind of leftover money from the NSF plus the money that the university came up with, we could see ourselves continuing. And this was important because what had happened, and this was not noticed or not really thought to be important by the experts, and thanks to Don Kirst, who was a accelerator plasma physicist in the department who had been involved in Tantalus, recognized what the critical problem was with the performance of the storage room.
What was his name?
Don Kirst, K-E-R-S-T. He passed, but he was a member of the department at that time. And he made some suggestions for installing what are charged strips called electrodes in the tank where the electrons circulate. And the idea was to pull the ions away from the path of the electrons. And he said that this was done at Tantalus and had a remarkable effect. And just to demonstrate the effect to everybody, we went up, and Tantalus was running at that time. And they turned off these electrodes in Tantalus, and then the electron beam just died off. Mm-hmm. So I mean, he just, sort of reminded people and demonstrated how important these clearing electrodes were. And so the staff, the SRC staff, picked up on this and paid attention to what Kirst said and started step by step installing these clearing electrodes in Aladdin. And it's not a simple job because you had to turn off the storage ring, open it up to air, in other words, the vacuum. You had to break the vacuum, and then you put in these leads and metal strips and so forth, and then you had to bolt it all together again and pump it out. And this could take several weeks because you have to do a lot of pumping to reach these very high vacuum. And as this process was underway before I went out there, but it started, I think, around January of 1985, maybe a little before. And the more electrodes, you know, the percentage of the ring that was covered by these electrodes increased, and as the, you know, as electrodes are being installed, and then with that increase was an increase in the performance of the ring, as measured by the amount of current that you could have circulating. And that, you know, we knew this, and people we talked to know it, but the NSF, for whatever reason, didn't pay any attention. And so Eric Bloch, you know, I think he just wanted to wash his hands of the whole matter, and so, you know, we're turning it off. And what happened then was that through backdoor channels of communication with lower down in the National Science Foundation in the Division of Materials Research, we got word that, yes, we understand what's happening, and keep up what you're doing, and just be patient. And so beginning, you know, in, as I said, early 1985 and continuing on throughout the summer and into the fall until it was completed. And very quickly after that, we reached our performance goals, which was 100 or 100 milliamps or some current. And, you know, we had met all the objections. The major objection was there's so little light because there's so few electrons going on. Hi, Bill.
Hi. Excuse me.
And now we met the design specifications. And NSF said, you know, submit a proposal.
Yeah.
And so we did. And it was reviewed and reviewed successfully. We were back in operation. Well, actually, we were never out of operation because that interim period with the funding was going down. We were starting to move equipment from Tantalus and keep that move that and install and begin operating it here. We weren't going to continue running the old ring no matter what happens. So we moved things down. And after that, you know, by the spring of 1986, the funding came through again, new funding, and you know, we were off and running.
Great. All right.
And there were, I mean, the people that were important there, Ed Rowe, actually my predecessor Keith Simon had replaced Ed Rowe. Ed Rowe was taken off the project, but we brought him back on in 85. And so it was Ed Rowe. Giorgio Mongritondo was a user, but very active and very vigorous you know, defender of SRC. Mm-hmm. And then we had also an accelerator physicist up from Argonne, Yang Lai Cho, was there for a while, and he and Giorgio and I went down to talk to the director. I remember that quite distinctly. And then, but Yang Lai went back to Argonne when Ed Rowe came back on board. And then after that, you know, things, you know, we started building up the program, and within, I forget how many months, but in a few months, we shut down Tantalus and just moved the operations over here. And then, you know, the facility just grew and, you know, had attracted more users.
Yeah.
And, you know, kept on and, you know, it's still going today.
Yeah, great. Great. Okay, maybe we could rewind a little bit and go to Tantalus.
Okay.
When did you come to Tantalus?
No, I didn't. Let me put it this way. I came out here in 1985.
Okay.
And Tantalus was running, but my attention was directed on Aladdin. And up to that time, I knew people who did research out here on Tantalus, but I, being a theorist, I didn't, you know, have any contact with
them.
I'd see them at department meetings and, you know, talk to them and so forth, but I was not involved in the research.
So you were involved with administration at Aladdin and research here as well?
Over the years, I became involved in research here and then still doing it. But initially, it was administration I mean, Aladdin and Tantalus were all part of the synchrotron radiation mm-hmm. center. They were not, I mean, they were separate units, but they were, you know, the staff. Yeah. It was a common staff. But I was doing administration, and I had my own research program in magnetism and magnetic materials, which at that time didn't have much, you know, overlap with the research going here. But so I kept the research going in, you know, one hand and administration in the other. I did drop teaching, and I dropped departmental administration. But other than that.
Okay. So maybe we can go to about 87 was when Aladdin was fully online and was starting to grow.
Yes.
Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Well, it's one of these things where, I mean, you know, how almost have to look at the proposals that went in and what was funded. But we had a mixture of beamlines, as we call them, or experimental stations. And we started off with mostly with the things that were done available on Tantalus, plus a couple of others that had been built for Aladdin and were sort of set to one side. And so we used the older equipment, and then over the years designed new types of equipment. They're what are called insertion devices, undulators, you hear that word. Mm-hmm. And those we were we were not unique among synchrotron facilities. Most of them were getting on board the insertion device train. But we did, on very low budget, we were able to build our own that were, you know, as good as or better than available at Brookhaven or some of the other places, Stanford.
Can you tell me a little bit more about the insertion devices?
Well, the first, there are two components. The insertion devices are arrays of magnets, which in our case sit outside the pipe where the electrons are going. And by controlling the strength of the magnetic field comes perpendicular to the plane of the ring, you can control the energy of the light coming out. And you, instead of having a broad spectrum, which is pretty much what you have now, just from what are called the bending magnets, you can concentrate that spectrum in some very narrow energy ranges, so you have a lot more intensity in particular ranges. And you can, by changing the settings or changing the strength of the field, you can shift these ranges around. They're probably on the website have diagrams of that.
Maybe a silly question. The insertion devices in between the injector and the ring itself, is that?
Into the ring as a structure. They're not inserted into where the electrons are going because they're in the vacuum, but they stand right outside. And you can go down and see them. You try and get a time when they're not running the ring and just ask someone to show you some of the insertion devices. Mm-hmm. I think there are four or five in operation now. And our first insertion device was actually one which had been used for many years at Lawrence Berkeley Laboratories, one of the first ones that was made with a new type of permanent magnets. And we got that out here and got it up and running. And then we hooked it up to a beam line, and we made use of it. And then we purchased another one, the second one, from a company that was going bankrupt out on the West Coast. And this was their last insertion device, and they brought it out and spent time setting it up. And then we built a custom beam line to go with that. And then the third was one that we designed and built here, a joint project involving SRC and PSL. And instead of having permanent magnets like the first two, it had electromagnets.
Okay.
And that was a project that was joint with SRC, construction involved PSL, but it was operated by SRC and users from the University of Illinois, Chicago, and University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign, I think. Again, the users provided the money for the instrumentation, and we, as the University of Wisconsin contribution, provided the insertion device.
Okay. Do you think you can guide me through the process of recognizing a problem, maybe like for the insertion device, and then engineering it, what you did, who you contacted?
Well, it's one of these things that where the contacts went out at many levels. I mean, the accelerator group and the engineering group, at the time that was headed by Bill Winter, he passed. And then with the users, and it's one of these things where, ideally, the users say, we would like a enhanced energy or enhanced output and these particular energy ranges. Mm-hmm. And the energy of the ring was set to either 800 million volts or 1 billion volts, but really very little in between. There wasn't often run in between those two ranges. And just knowing what the users wanted, knowing what the storage ring performance specifications were, we could, the people in the insertion device business could then work back and say, well, you need such and such insertion device, and your vacuum chamber is this big, and you can't compress it down very much. So, this is what the best we can do in the output. And then you go back to the users, and this is what we can do. And is this your final request? And they say, oh, they know they may modify their requests or have mm-hmm. second thoughts or something. And there's kind of a back and forth period that could extend for a couple of years, and then finally come to some decision, and then the detailed engineering starts. And it's either, if you're building it here for that one insertion device and for most of the instrumentation that uses these on the beam lines, the design work and the construction work is done here, or PSL or something like that. We built most of our own. But the insertion device, if it was made out of permanent magnets, would be made provided by somebody else, but you'd go to them and say, this is, what we would like, and you go out to a number of companies in the bidding process, and then they tell you, say, we can build it for such and such amount, and respond to the request for a quotation, and then the decision is made typically because of state purchasing regulations down on campus. Well, this is the lowest bidder, and is there any reason why they should not get the award? And you have to come up with something like the company's bankrupt or, just not capable. But that wasn't the case in people. And then, contract is signed between the university, really the state of Wisconsin. And then a year, 2 years later, the device shows up. I mean, there's some back and forth during construction, maybe testing at the manufacturer, mm-hmm. and then they bring it here and install it, and then you run through tests, and then you decide, do we accept this? And by that time, yes. And then it's a problem in accommodating these devices to the ring. You don't want to disrupt the flow of electrons around the ring, so you have to maybe put on additional controls. On the electrons to offset the effects of this the insertion device, but that they're well known ways of doing that, and they work pretty well.
In terms of materials and build quality, you mentioned like the passive magnets and then the electromagnets. Is there one that's preferred?
I think that most of them are the passive. They're the magnets made with rare earth, iron boride magnets. because they have stronger fields. You're limited to the field that you can generate with an electromagnet. And so the electromagnets are good for producing intense radiation at low energies, but for the major spectrum of interest to the people who are the users, it's better to use the permanent magnets. But they're a lot more expensive, and we could build our own electromagnetic insertion device for a quarter of what the cost. But and then there are some, I don't think we have any, I'm almost certain we don't have any now, but we talked about it a lot, as superconducting magnets. And those, you know, are also very expensive, but you can produce very high energy photons with them, X-rays and things. So it's, and they're also in use at national laboratories.
Okay. I asked because I believe it was Jim Taylor was telling me that when they're constructing the bending magnets, they said they had all the plates, and then they would mix them up to try and get an even distribution in the mechanical flaws within the magnets themselves.
Yes, that's right.
I try to understand the building components.
Well, you know, there's something similar with these permanent magnets, and that is that you get these little blocks of neodymium iron boride, I think is a common one, and they're not identical, and you mix them up for the same reason. You know, you don't want to have the strong ones over here and the weak ones over there, so you kind of smooth it out by randomizing the distribution.
Is there a way to test if you balanced it properly? Or?
Yeah, I think that you can measure the field. I mean, you build your array, and then you could make a field detector that goes down the line and measure the unit. What you're really interested in particular is the uniformity of the field. You don't want a lot of bumps and rattles and things like that.
Yeah. Maybe another technical question concerning the energies, the... Tanos right, or Aladdin right now runs at 800?
Yes, except I think often after midnight at 1 GeV.
Okay.
I don't know. There was more of that some years ago when the people were interested in what was called X-ray lithography, and they made use of the higher energy.
Okay. I understand that the current relates to how much light is going to be coming out, and the energy relates to what frequency will be coming out.
Yeah, it's more, it relates to the maximum. I don't know. You don't have any of the brochures, do you?
Not with me.
Okay. That's something that you ought to get a hold of.
Are you talking about like kind of the black body spectrum?
Well, it's not black body. I mean, actually, the synchrotron puts out into the infrared and beyond, the longer wavelengths. But you get up to, and then there's a sharp cutoff. Mm-hmm. So it's not black body, but it is continuous with a sharp cutoff. Black body, it's just continuous out indefinitely. But the synchrotron radiation has, and their formulas, that I think it varies the cutoff frequency, or the varies with the fourth power of the energy. That's the photon frequency, or photon energy varies with something like the fourth power of the energy of the circulating electrons.
Okay. So how does, I'm trying to figure out empirically or physically what a higher energy means for an electron.
Well, it's the energy of motion, and electrons have mass, very little, but some. And if it were moving slowly, what we call non-relativistically, with electron moving with speed much less than the speed of the light, the energy it would have, the kinetic energy, would be one half product of the mass and the square of the velocity.
Yep.
Okay, one half of its Newtonian type. When you get up to electrons that are moving with speeds close to the speed of light, it's a different formula. It's due to Einstein and.
Yeah.
In the case of Aladdin, I mean, the electrons move like, I don't know, 0.999 the speed of light.
So when you're increasing the energy, you're basically adding another 0.9 to it.
That's right, or even less. I mean, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, it takes a lot of power. You have to put power in, and you know, you're limited. Also, the magnets that keep the electrons moving you can't put in too much energy because the magnets can only produce so much of a bend. Mm-hmm. And if they, you know, you're just like a car going around a racetrack. It's going too fast. Electrons are going too fast to have too much kinetic energy. They won't make it around.
Yeah.
So it's, you got to figure in the radius of curve, what's called the radius curvature of the magnets. So to keep in, and it has to be consistent, and the energy of the electrons have to be consistent.
Yeah.
You can tune that, you can adjust for different electron energies by adjusting the magnetic fields of the electromagnets, what are called the bending magnets, but you can only do so much. So you can have a weak field and weak, low kinetic energy, or you can have a medium field and medium kinetic energy. But you can't keep going on and up because you can't raise the field above 1.5 tesla or something like that.
I was thinking about that with Tantalus. Tantalus was so small, so
yeah.
the angle. So does that mean they had a stronger bending magnet?
No, they had probably about the same. That's limited by properties of iron. But they had lower energy.
Okay.
They had, I think, maybe 400 or something, 300 MeV,
mm-hmm.
Whereas Aladdin was 800 or 1 GeV.
Mm-hmm. Okay. How about moving on from there? So we talked about the insertion devices and engineering from that.
Mm-hmm.
What else were you involved with, either administratively or scientifically?
Well, I was involved working with Hartmut Hoechst, and he, I guess, building a type of device for producing circularly polarized synchrotron radiation. What comes out of the ring is linearly polarized,
mm-hmm.
and you want to make it circular, left or right circular polarization for studying magnetic materials. And Hartmut, and working with engineers, and I had a graduate student doing some of the theoretical work there's a quadruple reflection polarizer that was designed and built at PSL, and that was really the first, I guess, real instrument of its type. And Hartmut provided the sort of scientific specifications, make sure that, and the materials, and suggested the materials for the mirrors to produce the reflection. And then people at Fred Middleton, who's retired now, but he was an engineer, design engineer at PSL, made it into a real thing, and then PSL built it, and it was installed over there for a while. and then there were some preliminary measurements and scientific studies carried out, and my student Dai Zhao helped with the analysis, but Hartmut could tell you much more about
that. Can you explain a little bit of what it does and how it manipulates the signal?
Well, what you can do, are you familiar with the polarized light?
No, please.
Oh, okay.
The
light is propagating in this direction along the path of my fingers,
mm-hmm.
and the electric field in the electromagnetic wave is oscillating perpendicular to the direction of propagation.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And if it's oscillating in one along a line perpendicular, we say that is linearly polarized.
Okay.
And you can also have the electric field rotating in the plane perpendicular to the direction. And that's circularly polarized, and you can have things in between those which are called elliptically polarized. And the situation with the storage ring facility is that the radiation from the bending magnet is linearly polarized. And there are certain experiments, particularly with magnetic materials, where you learn more by using circularly polarized radiation than you do with linearly polarized. Has to do with the magnetization, and like a magnetic field, and electrons move around, spiral around a magnetic field, and these are the electrons in the solid that you're investigating, and by coming in with a circularly polarized beam, you can look, you could probe more deeply into the magnetic okay. properties. And so the thinking was to use a, what people were doing in those days, and they're still doing it now, was to build polarizers, insertion devices, having arrays of magnets that you could adjust and produce circularly polarized radiation. But we couldn't afford it at those times. So we designed and built our own circularly polarized quadruple reflection polarizer to do the same thing. And at a low energy, it wasn't quite as effective, as, but it was a lot cheaper, like a factor of 10 or something. Mm-hmm. And we got that operation, some nice experiments done. Recently, like this or this past year, the Synchrotron Center received a insertion device which with these adjustable magnets, which, so they can now produce circularly polarized okay. radiation with having, not having to go through this reflection business.
Mm-hmm. So how does the reflection cause that to change?
Well, there are certain materials, in this case, when we used it was gold films, which can change the degree of the character of the polarization of the light. So if you come off with something strictly linearly polarized, it'll give it a little bit of a twist.
Mm-hmm.
And if you take advantage of the optical properties of the polarizer, and the optical properties of the gold, and it, you know, make the right adjustments. If you combine three, or for engineering reasons, four reflections, you can take linearly polarized and one end reflects here, 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 and then back down to the beam again, and you produce circularly polarized light.
So this is probably a very Newtonian question, but does that alter the energy? Does that?
No, it doesn't. It doesn't alter the energy. In any perceptible way, the frequency of the light is the same, but this polarization character changes. It was a former SRC user, Neville Smith, who first suggested this, but you know, many years ago. But Hartman Company were the first, and Fred Middleton and PSL were the first to build a practical one.
And you said it was the magnetic field or the electric field?
It's the electric field, electric light.
Okay.
But having circularly polarized light allows you to study magnetic materials, which by definition respond to magnetic fields.
Mm-hmm.
So it gets a little complicated, but you can imagine the spinning electric field connects with the different atomic levels in this magnetic solid.
Okay. That's all the questions I have for now.
Is there
anything else? Last
no. I think that's about it. I think but think about it. And I would look up things on the website.